Presiding Judge Loken, and may it please the court. I'm Clemens Erdahl. It's my honor to represent Cordero Seals. Mr. Seals is currently serving a 30-year sentence. Like the Supreme Court case of United States v. Barrage, this case involves the application of the causation requirement under the serious injury enhancement of Section 841B1C. Thankfully, in the case at bar, the victim, J.V., recovered from his overdose, unlike the victim in Barrage. Also, thankfully, we know from the Barrage case that the enhancement requires a showing of but-for causation. We also know the Barrage majority explicitly endorsed and implied the factual causation test as traditionally understood. Namely, the government must prove that a harm would not have occurred in the absence of, that is, but for, the defendant's conduct. Barrage was a mixed drug intoxication case, and it was unclear from the evidence in that case whether the drugs supplied by the defendant were a but-for cause of the victim Banca's death. The expert in Barrage simply could not answer whether the victim would have lived had he not taken the heroin supplied by Barrage. The facts of this case are substantially similar to Barrage, and the government in the case at bar has likewise failed to carry its burden. The victim, referred to as JV, had overdosed 4 days earlier and had a multiplicity of drugs in his system, including four opiates. The key issue in the case is whether or not the government satisfied the actual causation requirement as set forth in Barrage v. United States. Barrage held that at least where the use of the drug distributed by the defendant is not an independently sufficient cause of the victim's death or serious bodily injury, a defendant cannot be liable under the penalty enhancement unless such use is the but-for cause of the injury. In Barrage, the Supreme Court reversed the defendant's conviction because the government itself conceded there is no evidence that Banca would have lived but for his heroin use. In short, because the government could not satisfy the but-for causation test. Likewise, in the case at bar, there is no evidence that JV would not have overdosed but for his use of heroin and fentanyl provided by Mr. Seals, because there was no evidence ruling out or otherwise excluding the acetofentanyl found in his blood as the actual cause. The expert testimony narrowed down the cause of JV's injury to morphine, fentanyl, or acetofentanyl, which is classified under Schedule 1 as a fentanyl analog. While Mr. Seals did provide JV with heroin and fentanyl, the government does not assert that there is any evidence that Seals did provide JV the acetofentanyl. The government concedes in briefing that drugs provided by Mr. Seals were not independently sufficient to cause serious bodily injury. So the only remaining issue is whether those drugs...
The government concedes that?
Yes, at page 43 of the government's brief, they say in footnote number 2, the government concedes that were the court to overturn the jury's finding on the statutory enhancement for count 1, that's the remand. The government at page 43. Does agree that they're not arguing the independently sufficient cause exception to but for. So it's at page.
Yeah, but you said that the government concedes there's no evidence that he wouldn't have died from the drugs. The way you said it sounded wrong.
Well, it's a difficult. Let me go back to that then.
Well, what the quote is, it says, "For the purposes of this appeal, the United States does not contend that the defendant's heroin and/or fentanyl was independently sufficient to cause the injury." In this section of the brief, however, the defendant claims that in order to prove. Wait, that's the government's brief, isn't it?
Yes, that's the government's brief.
All right.
So that was the sentence I was referring to, Judge Erickson. What I was trying to say, Judge Loken, was that what we're dealing with here is the but-for cause, and this is a mixed drug intoxication case involving the very same complex issues that the Barrage Court had to address. Of course, the case would be simple if all the drugs found in JV's system were attributable to the defendant, because in that case, no matter the type of interaction between the drugs, the ultimate cause of injury would be the result of the drugs provided by the defendant. However, in mixed drug intoxication cases where a substance not provided by the defendant is identified as a possible actual cause, the government must satisfy its evidentiary burden by putting on some evidence.
Well, I get they have to put on some evidence, but in this case, there's the evidence of the expert, but there's also just the facts as it played out, right? I mean, what's the guy's name? Starts with a V.
JV.
JV, yeah. He is walking around, talking, having no problem, is a bit antsy, gets the drugs from the defendant, goes into the restroom, mixes the drugs with water, injects the dope. He then comes back to the pump, and then and everything seems, it's all captured, you know, on video, right? And so everything seems all okay. It's all copacetic, right, until he gets to the gas pump, and then he just sort of collapses. Now, isn't that sufficient to say that but for the injection of the drugs in the restroom, he would not have had this incident?
Well, I think under Barrage, we have to look at what drugs were in his blood and what drugs he'd taken previously and have some evidence to rule those out.
A death case is different than a serious injury case. Here he takes the Mr. Seals drugs and immediately collapses. Now apparently fentanyl is often taken by addicts in order to counteract what's already in their system so they feel better or get unsick. Well, if that happens and he collapses as a result of what he's just taken,
well,
but for causation of a serious injury.
Well, it could have been under Barrage a contributing factor. The problem here is a lack of evidence about when he took the acetafentanil, which the government doesn't say he took.
It doesn't matter. The last thing he took resulted in a collapse.
But the expert is unable to say that. The expert says the acetyl.
I don't care what the expert can say. The facts as described, that's what happened.
Well, he says he's making an educated opinion that it was the timing.
Judge Erickson says you can look at the facts.
I would concede that the facts do not look good for Mr. Seals and that the timing is not good. However,
I think it's a harder case if it's a death case for the government than it is if it's a serious injury case. I don't deny that it's still a but-for causation standard, but you can't just take all of the analysis in the Burrage death case and apply it without further analysis to a serious injury case.
Well, Judge,
how about Volkman? If we agree with Volkman, do you agree that there was sufficient showing of but-for causation?
I think Volkman is somewhat different.
Sixth Circuit case. Well, you spend many, many pages on the exclusivity argument, which I'm not even sure I understand. But as I understand it, it's clearly rejected in Volkman. And I don't know if we don't agree with exclusivity, in other words, if we agree that a combination of drugs can result in a conviction for serious injury so long as there's the jury reasonably finds but for causation.
Well, in the briefs, we refer to the requirement as an exclusivity rule, arguing there must be some evidence excluding a substance not provided by the defendant as a but for cause. However,
the judge was urging us to take the restatement third of torts as applied to civil litigation,
right,
and just lift it into this context.
Well, I believe that's pretty much what Judge Scalia does. as you point out, with respect to a death case, after reviewing the expert's testimony, it would be more accurate to say the government must provide some evidence excluding a substance not provided by the defendant. Dr. Pruitt stated that either the morphine, the fentanyl, or the acetophenanyl acting alone could have caused JV's injuries. He did not state that either one could have been.
Cross-examination, he acknowledged that you would have to know when and how it was taken.
And he says he would have to have the concentration to know that.
Well, the government does not have to prove the negatives with someone who's got all this stuff in their system on these facts, in my view. The government doesn't have to prove the negative as to all those other drugs.
Well, I reserve the rest of my time, Judge, and I'll come back and we can.
Is there any case post Burrage that?
I think the Gaylord case is a fairly similar case to the one we have here.
Wasn't that a 2255? I can't.
Yes, it was.
Well, that's a lot different context.
But the ultimate holding in Gaylord is that the Seventh Circuit found that the district court erred because Gaylord alleged facts to support his claim that his counsel performed efficiently by failing to provide him with the postmortem and forensic pathology, but underlying that, they indicate that they had to know whether the oxycodone was the actual cause or whether the drug that was already in his system was the cause. And so we had to look at those pathology reports. Here we have a blood screening. It's not a blood test. It doesn't show the concentration. And Dr. Pruitt said that in order to say whether the acetophenanyl was the sole cause, he would need to know the concentration in the blood.
Sole cause is not the standard. Unless we take your exclusivity concept and apply it very strictly, then the government has to rule out everything else, including last night's whiskey.
Okay.
Isn't that basically what you're arguing?
Well, I think that, again, Judge Scalia has pointed out that in many of these cases, I think he says something 46%, there are other drugs in someone's system when they overdose. An overdose is an overdose, whether there's a death or not, because the penalty is for causing the injury. And so in the same way, they would have to prove that.
And so your argument essentially is that what he took that day that he received from the defendant had to be an independent, sufficient cause to cause the serious bodily injury in this case.
Right.
All right. Now, here's the question that I had in looking at the evidence, and maybe it's in there and I just missed it in the record. And it is, do we know that this acetophenanol was not merely a residue within the drugs that were actually sold by the or delivered by the defendant?
There was no acetophenanol found in the top of the
trace can. Yeah,
yes.
I see that.
So the government has never argued, nor do they say there's any evidence to show that my client provided the acetophenanol. So I think from what was presented to the jury, we have to take it as fact that the acetophenanol was not provided by my client.
And I just wanted to know if that's kind of what I had seen, and I was just, you know, that I'm sure as well as I do that acetophenanol is frequently found as a trace in mixtures that contain heroin and fentanyl. But we never had a quantity. This was just a trace a residue evaluation, right? So they never really had.
And that, I think, is the real flaw in the case, is a lack of a knowable quantity in the blood, which the expert from the government says is the only way he could rule out the acetophenanol as the cause of death, because he says it by itself could be the cause of death, and it's at pages 59 through 61 of the expert testimony, which was part of the trial. Thank you.
Adam.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I think the court has honed in on what the key issue here is, and I want to start by highlighting exactly the posture that we're looking at here. We're not in the abstract and generally trying to determine what legally causes a death. We're talking about a jury verdict. We're talking about a finding by a jury. And so the court here has to accept all reasonable inferences supporting the verdict. As Judge Loken pointed out, we don't need to exclude every reasonable hypothesis except guilt. And really what the court is looking for is whether there's any interpretation of the evidence that could lead a reasonable jury to convict. And so the uncontested facts here are that the defendant sold the drugs to the victim, that the victim shot up those drugs, that being heroin and fentanyl, in the bathroom of the gas station.
In your research, what would you say is the best post-Burrage case applying Burrage's analysis to a serious injury charge?
Your
Analyzing
Honor.
Analyzing how you do that, how you go from one context to the next, to the other.
You know, there's not a whole lot of cases out there on serious injury, frankly, as far as appellate cases.
Are there
any? When you ask the question, I'm struggling to think. I think most of the cases that I found, if not all the cases, were death cases. And I think your point in questioning Mr. Erdahl is absolutely correct, that they're different.
Well, then help us. How are they different, and how does it affect the analysis?
Well, ultimately, they're different factually. I don't think the analysis is any different. But when you have a death case, you have necessarily a medical expert trying to take a picture of a postmortem picture. They get the blood. They then try to extrapolate or take the evidence that they have and then draw a conclusion from that. In an injury case, in particularly this injury case, we have more than just that postmortem snapshot of what was in the blood. We actually have on video here and the live witnesses' testimony as to the course of events. And Judge Erickson, I think you're absolutely right that the jury is allowed to and required to look at all of the evidence, not just this snapshot of what was in the individual's blood sometime after the injury here.
You know, that's all true, but the defendant's argument that if you look at Burrage itself, it does seem to leave the impression that as you weigh out the evidence that you have to show that but for the introduction of the new system that are the new drug into the body systems that the injury would not have occurred. That's the first thing. And I guess you can inferentially draw that because the guy was walking around talking and didn't seem to have any problems, and you draw from that as well the expert's testimony that acetafentanyl has a half-life, which is, what, one-eighth the half-life of heroin or one-fourth the half-life of heroin? I don't remember what it was, but it's much shorter, so it...
No, actually, there is no evidence in this record as to the half-life of acetylfentanyl, and that was asked of Mr. Karras, the
okay.
FBI.
Was it the fentanyl that he was talking about?
I believe he said that, yeah, the half-life of fentanyl was 2 to 3 hours. Yeah. But he said there's been no testing done or there's no research.
Fentanyl is faster-acting than heroin, right?
Yes.
And there is no evidence in this record about the acetylfentanyl, if
Correct.
I'm mistaken on that. I'm sorry.
So, and I think that's really the key to this entire argument with respect to the acetylfentanyl. We don't know, and the jury doesn't know. There's no evidence in the record suggesting how long acetylfentanyl might be detectable in the blood. It is a designer drug. It's one of those analogs of fentanyl. And so at this point, there is no evidence as to how long that might stay in the blood. It could stay in the blood for a day or be detectable in that way. We have no idea. The jury had no idea. And that's sort of a critical fact here, is that what the jury had, and again, we're looking at a jury finding. The jury found that the heroin and fentanyl that the defendant distributed, that JV used in that bathroom and then minutes later collapsed and had severely impaired breathing and was well on the road to death, they found that heroin and fentanyl is what caused that injury. And so... It is entirely possible that, Judge Erickson, as you pointed out in questioning Mr. Erdahl, it's entirely possible that the substance also contained acetylfentanyl. We just don't know. What we know is that the substance, in fact, contained heroin and fentanyl. That's what the paraphernalia tested positive for. And so There's the question, though, is on a jury finding whether there's any reasonable hypothesis. We don't know if it was in the substance. It could have been from something, as I mentioned, since we don't know the half-life of the substance, it could have been from something he had taken the night before and still went in the blood. The jury wasn't required to find, as a matter of law, that the substance, that the acetylfentanyl was in the substance that he had sold at 3:55 or whatever it was, whatever time the actual transaction occurred on November 4th. The jury here found that the substance that was distributed by the defendant was heroin and fentanyl, and that it was used. And that's entirely consistent with the physical evidence and Mr. Viner's testimony.
Now just humor me on this. I think Burrage stands for the proposition that if, in fact, the second ingested drug is a mere contributing factor to the death or the serious bodily injury, that's insufficient. And I believe the defendant is arguing that because of the lack of quantitative analysis of the blood, you cannot tell whether or not the substance sold by the defendant was a mere contributing factor to the substantial bodily injury. And I think they would, in fact, concede that that's true, because just the timing of it is he collapses at the gas pump. They can't really argue that it didn't play any role. But what they're saying is you need to establish but have failed to establish the fact that in the absence of the acetafentanyl, he still would have suffered this serious injury, this bodily injury, right? That's what their argument is.
Why are they
wrong under Burrage?
They're wrong under Burrage under the facts of this case because we don't know. There's an entirely reasonable interpretation of the evidence that acetylfentanyl was there, Your Honor described before, while he was walking around, while he was going into the bathroom. So if that is in his system and it's not caused the injury, and that's entirely consistent with Dr. Pruitt's testimony,
exactly,
which is whatever the last opiate he took, that's what caused the injury. That's the gist of that testimony, and that's what he testified to.
And why was that? And was the problem in Burrage really the lack of expert testimony that tied that together?
I believe so. And realistically, in a death case, that's why I mentioned before that death cases are a little different than these injury cases.
We get that death cases are different. We say that all the time. The problem with this is the enhancement in the statute says death or serious bodily injury, right?
It does.
And so really the analysis must necessarily be the same, and doesn't it? Or
I would agree the legal analysis is the same. If we're applying the same but-for causation test, it's just that the facts of the cases as they arrive and the nature of the conclusions that have to be drawn are just naturally going to be different. As I mentioned, postmortem toxicology and postmortem testimony by a medical examiner oftentimes is going to be really heavily focused on the concentration of the drugs in the person's system. That's just what they're going to have to do. And factually, it's going to be different than this case, because if you think about a postmortem toxicology situation, they can take all the blood that they want, all the blood that they need. What happens here is JV goes to the hospital. He gets some blood taken. They test as much of it as they need to do their tests. All that's left is like a thimbleful, I think, is what Mr. Karras testified. And then he's out of the hospital, and he leaves of his own accord. So the government only has the blood, the tiny little bit that was there, and there's not enough there to do a quantification. So that's why it's different in that, factually speaking, you're going to have to look at the entire picture, which you would in a death case as well, but you just can't pin the entire result on of whether an injury was caused by a particular substance based on a tiny amount of blood that was taken at some undetermined time after the injury occurred. And that's Dr. Pruitt's testimony with respect to the need for determining the quantification of a particular substance, or you need to know how much the concentration was, that would be at the to determine whether it caused the injury. That would be at the time of the injury. This blood was taken sometime substantially after. It could have been an hour later. And obviously blood, the substances are being processed out of the blood, and you're not getting the same snapshot as what had happened. So, yes.
Well, actually, with these particular drugs, given the enzymes in the blood itself, it's if you delay 2 weeks to test it, there's still some ongoing changes in the drugs, right? I mean, isn't that one of the things they talk about opiates generally, is that they're fairly unstable? They break down into heroin breaks down to morphine almost immediately, and so does fentanyl. And then they're left with these trace elements. But like with alcohol, it stops breaking down once you take the blood out of the body. And there's apparently some period of time where those drugs within the blood continue to metabolize even in the absence of the blood being actually oxygenated, and they only stop changing when the blood becomes completely anoxic, which is some period of time, right? So if we test that blood, you know, 5 minutes later, after it's drawn, and we test it an hour later, that there is some minor difference. Is that's what I understand the science to be, but maybe it's pseudoscience.
I think we're outside the context of the record.
I'm
not sure why you accepted Judge Erickson's description of what Burrage held. It seems to me that famous hypothetical makes it a straw that broke the camel's back analysis appropriate.
Yes, and that's what we argued here, and that's what we are arguing.
The way he stated the holding in Burrage, and you didn't challenge it. I didn't hear him right.
Perhaps I misunderstood the question, but that's absolutely what we're arguing here. We're talking about the straw that broke the camel's back.
Well, what I understood him to say is if the defendant's drug just was a contributing factor, the government loses. And I don't think that's what Burrage, the analysis, if you play it out, including the hypothetical, I don't think that's what Burrage said.
I think the reason I answered the question the way I did, and when you talk about a contributing factor, it's looking back to the pre-Burrage or Burrage case law, where this court had held that it only needed to be some factor contributing to the end result. So when I hear the term contributing factor, it's sort of term of art.
That's true, but I'm not sure how much of the prior law was overruled by Burrage.
Well, I think when it comes down to it, when we have to look here, it is the but-for cause. And so whether one phrases it as, well, this was the straw that broke the camel's back, therefore it contributed to the death, then that would be correct.
In an injury case, if he wouldn't have taken that drug, if he wouldn't have taken, if the government proves if he wouldn't have, or satisfies to the jury satisfaction, reasonable satisfaction, that he wouldn't have collapsed if he hadn't have taken the drug that the defendant just sold or transferred to him, why isn't that sufficient under Burrage?
That is sufficient. That is what Burrage says, and that's what we proved here. Yes, that's correct.
So, I mean, contributing factor, sure. The acetyl fentanyl, the person who sold him JV acetyl fentanyl 4 days earlier, if charged with this crime, would have a heck of a good argument under Burrage.
Yes, that would be a problem.
They're both contributing factors, but one of them is but-for.
That's correct. Okay. So I believe I've covered all of the arguments that I intended to cover. So if there are no additional questions, I'll rely on the brief and ask that the court affirm. Thank you.
Mr. Erdahl, for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just on that point, there was no evidence that he was provided the acetylfentanyl that was in his bloodstream 4 days earlier. There was evidence he had overdosed.
Okay.
The 4 days is what scared me there, Jay.
Well,
okay.
I mean, if it was 4 hours.
Yep.
It seems to me that if you were defending the seller of acetylfentanyl, whether it was hours or days before this transaction, you would be making about the same argument. It would be much more factually plausible, or whatever the word would be.
May I follow up on a couple of questions? I realize some of my time was used up, Your Honor. On page 891 of Burrage, Judge Scalia does reject the contributing cause and the multiple independent sufficient causes which were urged by the government at that time. Following up on the fentanyl analog, the failure to get the blood draw or to have the proper evidence before the court is not something that can be blamed on the defendant. It's the government's burden to put forth the evidence necessary. And in this case, they had no evidence to show that the acetafentanyl was not the cause, and in fact, their own expert said by itself it could have been the cause.
You are repeating your main argument.
Okay, but the jury, but what happened is that my esteemed colleague said that the jury didn't have evidence on that. This is our point. The jury was left to speculate, and the burden was on the government to put that evidence on. That would be the point that I wanted to make, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case has been well briefed and argued, and we'll take it under advisement.